a near timeline science fiction movie. Like, in other words, 20, 50, less than 100 years in the future. And the people are in a spacecraft, and there's no claustrophobic spacecraft thing, where it's like they have entire rooms that just have a desk in them in a spacecraft, where it's like, that's not believable to me that, like, 20 or 40 years from now, we're going to – just space travel has been conquered so much that we can have all this space. No, it's going to look like a submarine.
It's not going to look like a condo.
Yeah. And so, like, in this – where Into the Midnight Sky, the George Clooney movie, there's endless shots of that where it's like we're in this spacecraft and they have so much room, you know.
It's not going to look like Star Trek.
You're not
going to have this huge bridge.
Report to the bridge.
Yeah.
You're not going to have that. First, the thing has to be built. In order for it to be that large, it would have to be built in space.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got this nagging little thing that you
which you can assume.
That's a pretty simple argument.
You can assume that they build it in space. But if you're building it in space, it's not just like...
I mean, we've already built space stations in space. We've actually done that. That's
real. We built them
now.
Here. We set them up and connected them.
Right, yeah.
We didn't build them from scratch.
But regardless of how...
It's like a modular home. You build it there.
But regardless of how you build it, you're not going to have a giant room for a desk.
No.
You're not going to have that. And yet they do that in this Into the Midnight Sky movie. And the movie closes, spoiler alert, where...
I don't think so, because I'm not going to watch it.
Well, I'm talking about our
if the listeners are watching,
audience.
It's your own fault.
Yeah.
You did this to yourself.
But at the end of the movie, basically everybody dies except for two people left on this spacecraft.
Oh, now it's a fucking Vonnegut novel.
Who head off, they head off, and it's like, they're like, wow, I guess the Earth is dead. So they head back to this, like, inhabitable moon of Jupiter, and what is it? It's a man and a woman, and gee, they're going to be the Adam and Eve that restarts
the
human race.
Oh, man.
Except the thing that's like, it's...
And scene.
It's so...
That's a loud trope. Not even a quiet one.
You
want to
hear worse?
Trope.
You want to hear worse?
Sure, because this is beyond the Swedish movie.
It's so bad that, like... When they realize this, the Earth is getting consumed by itself, and George Clooney is on Earth, and he's dying, and they just give up, and they circle around and go back to the Jupiter moon. The two people left on the spacecraft are like, yeah, I guess it's just us now. And they're sitting in the bridge, and then the credits start rolling.
Did they at least have like
and
a...
They
fell in love
they're sitting there,
in addition
the credits
to
start,
really make it, Trey?
Pretty much. The credits start rolling... And
it's much more appropriate to be there in that place with somebody you don't fucking like.
It's going to start like this, is
exactly,
it?
Yeah.
So you sit there as the credits are rolling, and you're like, so they're the Adam and Eve. And they're literally on the bridge, on a desktop, you know, a desktop with all the lighted panels down there, you know, all that kind of crap. And they sort of turn off the lights one by one and go down the stairs and leave the office. And it was just like... Well,
and no porn music or nothing?
It's totally like, guess it's quitting time. Click.
Oh, no, because they totally set you up for part two, which is the ending of WALL-E, where somebody on Earth, some little robot, says, okay, it's okay to come back to Earth. And these two people and all the people they built are going to come back to the new Earth and plant the new plant and be the Adam and Eve on Earth again. And they set this up for a sequel.
But the whole premise of the plot is... The Earth is dying, so Earth sends out some spaceships to this conveniently newly discovered moon of Jupiter that seems to be able to sustain life. They send off these spaceships to go check it out, see what it looks like, guys, and then come back and tell us why. I don't know, because I guess... So then they're on their return trip to tell the people on Earth that they think are still there... Like, hey, you know, this place looks pretty good. They got a 7-Eleven, some nice Sicilian pizza, you know. And so the people are on their return trip, and you're just like, they couldn't just radio, hey, gang, it looks great. Come on. Well, okay, that's kind of – all right, so suspension of disbelief there. And then George Clooney is sort of the last man on Earth, and he's in an Arctic station to communicate with them, except his antenna's kind of janky. And it can't communicate with them.
Which was something from your write-up. It can't. Is both have to make both people have failed antennas?
Yeah. Then the spaceship has a failed antenna.
To get to the moon on Jupiter, but we can't build a fucking functional Faraday antenna.
So then a solid hour of the movie is Clooney trying to communicate with them, them trying to communicate with, and it's like Burger King, you know, and it's like back and forth, and it really is just like when you call home from college to your parents and they start arguing on the extension. You know, it's just ridiculous. You're just like, really? This entire thing here is the spaceship gets all the way back to the Earth because of janky antenna, and Clooney can't wave them off. Hey, there's nothing here, guys. Just go back and have a fun time back on the Jupiter moon. And so they get all the way back. And then the plot device, which I truly hate. I can't stand it in science fiction movies where it's just like, we don't have enough fuel to get back to Earth. Or we don't have enough fuel to return to the Jupiter moon.
Safe place is. Yeah.
We can't do it. We have to land on Earth and get some fuel. Blah, 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 blah. And so then it's like, wait a second.
Did you just land on Earth next to the fucking rocket fuel disposalry or what?
What are we going to do? I don't know. You're the science officer. All right. They put together. Oh, my God. Here's what we can do. If we use Earth's gravity and slingshot around it, we'll pick up enough speed to get back to Jupiter. And it's just like, seriously?
Yep, that's tired.
Seriously? This is the most tired plot device in all of...
It's so tired that we've actually done that, too.
We've done that 20
million
times. Like,
we used the moon to actually fling us around back to Earth. We actually did that as humans, and it is such a failed plot device in that respect. This is not sci-fi anymore. This is 1960.
It is... It is...
8, 7.
It is the 9. Essence of The Butler Did It in sci-fi.
It is...
It's like, stop it. Don't
do
this.
Stop writing mystery novels.
The slingshot move is like so dumb.
I agree.
Just stop it. Don't do that shit.
Okay. So, yeah, don't watch that movie.
Don't watch that movie.
Clearly not sponsored by that movie. Ladies and gentlemen and everybody else listening, we are Ruined Heroes, a weekly free and self-produced podcast, wherein the three of us irreverently discuss a topic of societal renown.
No more.
I, Tyler, study like a guy who was kicked out of his country. John.
Bow down and worship me and I'll give you everything the eye can see. I've been listening to DKK.
Yeah, yeah. Did you buy the repress?
No.
And Rupert.
Is thankful for the world around me. All awakening.
I just gotta
That's
say
actually
it.
Probably pretty good
I
for
I was
him.
Gonna say it because he lit it up so well. Possibly the most woke thing you've ever said. So, anyway,
well, said awakening, so...
Probably the most woke... So, I know, you laid it up so well, I just couldn't let the ball fall flat.
Well, it was sort of an obvious...
So, please subscribe and leave good ratings and reviews on whatever podcast feed you get us through. It is free for you and it helps us, which is very cool.
Free for you and me.
To interact with us, we are RuinHeroesPod@gmail.com, as well as easily found on Facebook and Twitter, where you get weekly hints. Say hi if you drop by. We dig it when you do that. If you feel like helping with the cost of the show, you can subscribe at Patreon, patreon.com/RuinedHeroes, and get extra content for just $1 a month. There are links in the show notes, as well as on the website, RuinedHeroes.com, where you can also find the older and shittier episodes. Some, even though...
Arguably,
kinda,
they're all shitty. These must
true,
be older.
True. I was actually having a thought today, like...
Oh, fuck. Here
people,
we go.
People get all like, these guys are assholes. And you know what? I dare you to put out this level of absolute bullshit. Try it. It's hard to do
it
this.
It looks easy at home, folks.
It does. But really just sounding like the jackals that we do every weekend is way harder than you imagine.
Try and manifest this level of impromptu conversation for an hour every week.
Occasionally you fall in a pratfall of sounding intelligent, and we're good at not doing that. And so check us out. Like, it's harder than it looks. So,
anyhow, I think the real problem, though, is like if they're hearing that, they have checked us out.
That's true.
Because we've already lost anybody that just stumbled onto it from the 15 minutes of fucking Tyler Interruptus during the first of this episode.
Tyler Interruptus is strong this weekend.
I am helping us win in being absolute shite. So, thank you to those of you who do give to us. We dig it.
So, Tyler, what is this strange device in the middle of the table? It looks like an MCA Recordings bottle opener.
It is, but we're going to discuss that later because it was a possible intro.
Well, it's quite curious.
It is.
And
it's a record.
Oh, no,
you
I'm
really
sorry. It's
scratch.
Not MCA. It's Capitol Records.
It's a record
it?
You really want to scratch. Yeah, it's Capitol Records. Anyway, intros.
Is it Super Freak by Mr. Richard James?
No, it's even crazier. Anyway, and it's accidentally even crazier. Anyway, a intro.
Okay.
John and I finally got out of the 90s for you.
Wait, okay, so...
And we went to the 80s.
So I think...
And the 70s and the 60s and the 50s and the 40s and the 30s.
I think we've exhausted the period of my forewarned episodes where you guys both told me for a week in advance, every one, you're going to hate it. So I think we're at a I'm not going to hate it topic.
This was a we hope you don't hate it topic, yes.
Oh, okay. So questionable. I might hate it.
Specifically designed as a know. Hopefully Rupert doesn't hate it.
Okay.
And it was put solely on me.
It was put solely on John because I was tired of hearing his BS about I don't like your third option thing. So that's what I'm picking. And so I was like, here's the category you fucking pick.
Well, that's okay. That gives me hope because John's usually.
Oddly, he picked one of the ones that was going to be the first two on my list.
John's usually looking out for me because if John rejects a topic, 9 times out of 10, it's like John doesn't like it and he knows I'll hate it. So. I have Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles
was kind of just a fuck everybody. I wanted to watch the world burn on that one.
That one was totally John just wanted to fuck everybody.
That was one we don't like to think about.
It was funny, though.
They're all funny.
At least in the moment. Like I also had to bring to the listeners' attention recently that you guys remember what we say way better than we do. Like, this is just in the moment. We're not absorbing it. We're just spewing it. So when you bring up quotes, I think it's funny that you bring up quotes, but at the same time, I don't remember fucking saying that. So intro. These are all quotes by the topic, so you know it's a person. If you have divine motives, material beliefs will follow suit, but they are no longer material. They have become divine. Ooh, not bad, huh?
Joel Osteen.
Oh, God. He has come up as an option in the past. No, but you are kind of heading to the right train station.
And we've done Tony Robbins.
We've done Tony Robbins.
Yeah. Okay.
Allah did not create man so that he could have fun. The aim of creation was for mankind to be put to the test through hardship and prayer. An Islamic regime must be serious in every field. There are no jokes in Islam. There is no humor in Islam. There is no fun in Islam. There can be no fun and joy in whatever is serious. Islam does not allow swimming in the sea and is opposed to radio and television serials. Islam, however, allows marksmanship, horseback riding, and competition.
Okay, can you read the...
Really weird definition of Islam.
Can you read the first one to me?
Yeah. If you have divine motives... Material benefits will follow suit, but they are no longer material. They have become divine.
Mm, I'm thinking Ayatollah Khomeini.
Oh, hey! Oh!
Yep.
Back on your streak.
So you feel better about this one?
Well, when you read the second one, I felt if I don't get this, I'm going to really have some real self-hatred going on.
May I give you the third one?
Yeah, what's the third one?
We do not worship Iran, we worship Allah. For patriotism is another name for paganism. I say let this land, quote, Iran, burn. I say let this land go up in smoke, provided Islam emerges triumphant in the rest of the world. So, like, if you hadn't gotten the second one, you really would have felt guilty for not getting the third one.
Yeah. Do you, because of our age difference, I wonder, like, how big a figure...
We were 13 when he died.
Yeah. Intrinsically know Ayatollah Khomeini is not a good thing.
Yeah. That was kind of brought up. You know, that was in the news, all us being brought up. But we didn't have...
Not fully sentient. Yeah.
We didn't have the intellectual capacity to actually understand. It's kind of like, remember
when Lenin was shot. I remember it, but in this weird...
Oh, John Lennon.
Esoteric world. Yeah. Lenin with an E. Or an O. An O, not an I. Either way, yeah, that Lenin.
Lenin that has more N's.
Or Elvis, you know, those things. I kind of remember them, but in this, like, weird, vague space.
They're more of just a marker in a history book for us rather than an actual living understanding and fully.
Your brain is sort of like if you BitTorrent the History Channel. kind of get a janky version of it.
Yes, yeah. My brain is a lot like that, actually. Yeah. That is possibly the most accurate assessment I've ever gotten.
I've seen a
handful of shrinks and shit.
Yeah.
And for the record, it became apparent to me that this is a very confusing story, so there's a lot of shit I left out. There's a lot of stuff going on, but sources, iranchamber.com, Jewish virtuallibrary.org, biography.com, and english.alarabia.net. I don't know, alarabia.net. Also, for the record, there's a lot of shit that I cannot, as an American-speaking human being, pronounce. There's going to be a lot of...
You just got to use a lot of...
I'm just going to do my best. It's going to be as phonetic as I can. There's a lot of letters. Whatever.
John can do the guttural, like, ha thing more because, like, he's with the German thing, which is the closest that we have to Arabic.
Germans are possibly now the second most angry culture, right?
Macht free.
Macht frei.
Macht frei. Macht. But you got to hock it up. Macht frei.
Macht frei.
Yeah.
Like, sure. Even Silent Night is kind of terrifying in German. Just saying. So, born Ruhollah Mousavi. He was born Ruhollah Mousavi, September 20th, 1902, in Comaine.
Ruella.
Like, think Cruella.
There's no U's. There's no E's.
Ruhollah.
Ruella. Fuck it. I don't know. Again,
think Cruella. Think Cruella.
Okay,
just like
you know what?
Just let it go.
I just call him Khomeini. I call him Khomeini for the majority of things.
Okay, there
so it's
you
good.
Go. Just call him Khomeini.
But yeah, there's going to be a lot of this, as I just warned you, where it's just going to be.
Doesn't mean that we're going to not do it.
That's fine.
His name contemporaneously, meaning at the time, was Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
So
that was how he was known. Then.
He was born
in U.S. news.
Ruhollah,
I don't know about there.
Mousavi, which sounds like something I need to go
born
with dinner.
Mousavi.
Oh my God!
September 20th, 1902,
like
in Comaine, a small city southwest of Qom, Q-O-M, Iran. His family had long been full of religious leaders. When he was just about 5 months old, his father was killed, and he was left being raised by his mother, Hajar. H-A-J-A-R. And his aunt.
Yeah, no.
I fucking warned everybody. And his aunt, Shahiba.
Sound it out.
Phonetic as I can. Shahiba. I mean, why? First question is, when they translate shit, why can't they just make it totally fucking phonetic? Because I know it's coming from a totally different written language in the first fucking place. Can they just make it as phonetic as possible? And no, apparently that's
fucking
impossible.
You're translating a language that doesn't have the same alphabet.
Right.
Into our language.
I'm saying, but if there's a Q, put a fucking U after it so I know how to say it. And if it doesn't sound like Q, make it a K. Whatever. I've never understood that about translation.
Because English is obviously the only language on the face of this earth.
No, it's...
If I am in any
way expected to pronounce these things correctly, could you just make them, when you translate them, could you just make it phonetic?
Ours is the only one that uses the same set of letters, right?
No, you can't do that because,
true,
first of all,
every language has
like diphthongs that don't translate into English, first of all. Second of all, even if they did translate it, it wouldn't work for you because English is not a phonetic language.
Most other
languages are phonetic.
Okay.
So,
I mean, obviously you can't sound out like ancient Egyptians, like owl feather this pose. But like, you know, things like French and stuff like that, you can sound it out. But
so anyhow, he was left being raised by his mother and aunt, whose names I'm not going to say again because I'm fucking tired of it. Both of whom died of cholera when he was 15. This left his older brother, Sayed, which I do know how to say,
Morteza, in
charge of the family, because that's the way a lot of cultures do it. He was pretty athletic as well as a studious in his youth. It is said he was the leapfrog champion in his village.
That's... You know what that is? That's
actually
that means,
noted.
That means you get to leapfrog over the person that's standing on the
line. The leapfrog champion
of the village.
Why is it right now I want to see the leapfrog semifinals?
I know. In Iran.
Is this
in the early 1900s?
Is this sport still appreciated in this land? I just got to see the leapfrog trials.
I was in at least that was made more. It was in at least two of the sources, if not three. I was like,
is somebody standing on a landmine and then leapfrogging over?
Leapfrog.
Oh, I'm going to hell for that one.
One of those things I thought that, like, there was actually no superlative, that no, you can do it or you can't, not you're the best at it.
He was apparently champion of the village. I don't fucking know, dude.
How do you do it better?
We're so early in and we have such a great fact to teeter on for
like,
a while.
What makes the better leapfrogger?
I don't know.
Is this
you could jump over your dad? And he's, you know,
maybe it's
6 foot tall or whatever, so it's a long.
No, we're in the
version of free running.
Maybe
we're in the version of we're in the land of short men.
I know there aren't particularly tall people there.
No, not in Iran.
Their robe doesn't get caught.
Ah,
that's what it is. The robe doesn't get caught.
That is a questionable comment. Funny, but.
Here comes the woke. Hey, that's
ding, what. Ding, ding. We found Tyler.
Is there woke down the road? I see it coming off in the distance. Dude, let's form a posse.
There's those headlights.
Yeah.
You woke the woke bear.
Yep.
Yeah, well, fuck you. Go back to hibernation. It's
I have to say, playing leapfrog in a nightgown would pose problems.
It would be difficult.
I can see it, especially with bathing facilities.
Isn't the best clothing for leapfrog either buck naked or like really tight clothes like leggings or a unitard or
Oh, the best clothing for leapfrogs is Daisy Dukes. Ooh, regardless of which position you're in, the leapfrogger or the leapfroggy.
Everybody's winning.
Everybody's winning if it's all Daisy Dukes. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do is found the leapfrog championships and you have to wear Daisy
Dukes. Oh, dude,
Dukes.
You got to call out the professional tickling people. They'll be totally into this.
Oh, they can go to hell. They can stay there. Dante should make a new ring.
Don't crash my dream.
That is possibly our oldest joke.
Yeah, well, Dante needs to make another fucking ring just for the...
No, Phil Anselmo is our oldest joke.
I think the tickling thing came up before that.
No, it didn't.
It's arguable, I think.
Phil Anselmo was funny.
Our listeners will tell us. And didn't damage you as much, yeah. You had a funny uncle and a really creepy one.
I almost got carbonated
and
nasal.
The tickling, the tickling thing is the creepy.
No,
uncle,
we just don't talk about
so
that.
So anyhow, following in footsteps of his ancestors, he started studying the Quran. And in the very early 1920s, his brother arranged for him to study at Arak, which was then Sultanabad. This is kind of expected.
Sultanabad.
Yeah, I can say that. It's kind of cool.
Odd. Anytime you see something like that, it's
Bod.
Bod.
Okay.
It sounds like a city named after some nuts.
Dude, I was afraid we were going to have naan instead of pitas because I couldn't find the pitas for a second tonight. But anyway, flatbread.
I know what a pita is, you retard.
Yeah, so this was kind of expected.
Now I'm insulted.
This was kind of expected as the family believed they were descendants.
Yeah, this was kind of expected.
The family believed that they were descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. When this teacher left Arak in 1923 and moved to Qom, he followed not only to continue his religious studies. So essentially, the teacher went back to where he was from.
Name me a religious zealot of any faith that doesn't seem to think that they aren't related to some prophet somewhere.
Yeah, I think I successfully made it through the whole thing without using the word zealot, but extremely appropriate.
Wait, so what are you saying? This is like a bunch of Mexicans naming their kids Jesus?
Well, I was actually thinking that somebody was going to go find some book in a fireplace somewhere, or what? You know, you've got everything from the Mormons to,
even
Christianity.
Yeah. So, I mean,
you know, any Joel Osteen, these fuckers.
He'd become really attached to this teacher.
Oddly,
so when the teacher left the university he was studying at, university is a loosely used word. Rabidadad, I don't know what it is. It was something kind of like,
well, the university is a place of higher learning. So
yeah, it was a higher learning in the spiritual aspects of the Quran. Anyhow, when his teacher left the bigger city that he'd been sent to, the teacher went back to the tiny city, you know, where he was, where Khomeini was leapfrog champion of. Mm-hmm. And that's where they went, and he followed him. So, I mean, because that was what you did, especially in religious studies.
And what time, what year was this?
I mean, come on. Oh, dude, 1923, yeah.
Yes, you followed people around because, well, you did.
Yeah.
Well, let's also remember they don't have oil then. It's just newly been discovered, and, like, they're in the process of getting colonized by the British to take the oil.
Mm-hmm.
But
and then
I think,
later
I think,
divided by the UN, which is going to come up, yeah.
I think we should also pause to reflect that at least the Indians have some class. There's less people named Siddhartha or Dali, you know. They don't tend to do that. Or are there Chinese people named Confucius? No, not really. They're, but yet, everybody over here...
And most people whose last name was Hitler have changed their name. So, I mean, like, okay, we don't need to run down this path.
But no, but his point is valid.
I've taken one of these. I've given you so
many. Yeah, these are communal. They're totally communal.
His point here is valid. It's, you know, we have, you know, Jesus, Jesus. You have people naming Muhammad. You have, you're naming yeah.
How many
kids.
How many different cultures name children Mary?
That's the point he was making.
That's the point I'm making. But yet, you go over to these extremely religious cultures like India or, you know, conceivably, you know, China, Japan. You know, nobody's naming their kids like, you know, Siddhartha. You ever met some guy in India named...
I'm not going to disagree with you. I don't know that it's a vein that we need to continue exploring, however.
Well, sure, you're not...
Daddy, we got lots of shit, man.
You're not sitting there saying, like, you know...
Guy was busy.
All right.
It's one of those days.
Yeah, it is.
It
started off bumping.
Let's fucking brick wall this shit on him.
Well, we've had too much celebration for Christmas, so like now let's drive it into
the
ditch.
You guys, a whole three people, dude. It was fucking amazing. So anyway, where was it? All right, so somewhere in here, he took on the name of his hometown and became Ruella Khomeini.
Sounds kind of like a foxy chick.
Okay, well, it's okay. He's soon to become Ayatollah Khomeini. Ayatollah is an honorific. It's not an actual name change.
Sort of like Dr. Jill Biden?
Yes, it is.
More appropriately. More appropriately
fucking
being like,
people,
say
man, why is this a problem?
Don't do it.
It would be more appropriate to say father, as in like a church.
It's a spiritual leader of sorts.
I thought Ayatollah was explained in that time in the 80s as an honorific, and it meant, you know, teacher of Islam.
Yes. It's extremely, yeah. extremely well studied and thought out. And
but
yeah,
they've
it's,
got
a,
you know, thing, you know, yeah. In Islam, I think that they have a few words for that where imam is also similar. I think it's a similar thing. I'm sure there's a difference that I don't know about. But
they do, and this is a lot of projection on my part because I really don't know either. But they do have a number, and they come up, and he gets a bunch of them.
It basically means bow to your sensei.
He's also an imam.
Well, yeah,
The two terms aren't mutually exclusive.
Right.
But they do have different connotations. An imam is more of a strictly clerical point of view. Ayatollah means more of a
leader position.
Holistic?
More of an edge. One is saying he's a really good priest. The other one's saying he's the pope or in league with the pope or cardinal. So you can still be a priest. So imam is like priest, but then there's cardinal. So you're a priest and you're a cardinal.
You know,
Ayatollah would be cardinal.
I was going to comment, but I'm not educated enough. I'll just be speaking out of my ass. I'm going to move along.
Sharif don't like it.
Rock the Casbah.
I think that's going to be revisited.
Where was I? Okay.
Yeah, that's twice.
We keep going sideways here.
Too many bong rips this morning.
No.
And that boogie sound.
He also... So another thing that was going on is at the time part of the Islamic teaching was that Islam as religion was supposed to say stay separate from politics. And that was much of it was leader taught. And that also kept him from being active in politics. He was really starting to disagree with what was going on because Iran was moving to a much more progressive world, but he wasn't saying anything yet. It caused a huge rift that still exists in Iran today, this kind of break from a break of religion and politics.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Well, yeah, because there is, to some extent, my understanding in the religion of Islam, there is a political structure built into it, to my understanding. Again, very uneducated.
Well, you go first.
I should have.
In this time, this is the end of colonialism. Colonialism is clearly decaying. But, you know, the British have their oil interests in Iran and this kind of thing. And so the Western world was very aware that religious fervor in the oil section of the world, namely the Middle East, was a little bit of an impediment to them, like, you know, getting a good business going. And so they wanted to sort of deprecate the unity of Islam, because the one thing that they perceived was, like, there's all these warring factions within the Middle East, yet if they catch on, they will all unite behind Islam and get against us doing the oil thing, and we don't want that.
Keep the hives fighting so they don't gang up right. against us.
Right.
Yes.
So that's why
that goes on today.
But that's why, especially in Iran, the British and the United States and everybody had an interest in installing a more secular culture, and that's how a little bit later down the road, I'm sure, we get into things like installing the Shah of Iran.
We don't go directly into Stalin the Shah. We talk about him a lot. But yes, again, there was a lot of shit.
But some of
you can listen to some of our episodes.
The Western world is essentially scared to death of, we got this great new thing called oil.
Right.
Let's keep these guys from uniting in one front around Islam.
And it's the classic, and it started way back then. Let's sell them supplies and them supplies so that they can fight each other so that we can go harvest the oil over here.
Yeah.
And it's the same horseshit. Yeah.
That's one of the beautiful things that was going on. They had a lot of infighting, but they had one...
Beautiful is a curious word. Go ahead.
They had one connecting thing. You needed to keep them at odds to be able to deal with them individually, but if you pissed them off...
Right, which I think is what we're saying, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It goes back, however, to, you know, we're not talking about, you know, the 200 or 400 or 800 years. We're talking about millennia of religious-based...
Broken society.
Political
structures. Well, let's also not forget that, like, Europe has the very, you know, old enemies die hard. Europe has the very real thing in their head that, like, look, the last time these jokers got together, they came up through Spain.
They called them the Turks, and it was not a great deal.
They fucked everybody in the ass.
Well, we had
they guerrilla fucked everybody.
We had the Moors and the Moorish invasion of Europe from the left-hand side of the map coming up through Spain and all that kind of horseshit because these guys couldn't sail. So they come up through Spain, and then you had, like, the Ottoman Empire coming up on the right side of the map, and it's like the next
Europe
thing you know.
Shrunk really fast.
Yeah.
We're not happy about it.
The next thing you know, we got the Dark Ages.
I said, they gorilla fucked everybody between them.
Yeah.
So that's the idea, is you keep them going, you keep them happy, and you
keep them fighting down there.
Right.
Keep them fighting down there. We
Over
don't
there.
Want them coming up
Over
here.
There. It's kind of like having more than one kid. When the kids get quiet, look out. There's a coup coming.
Yeah.
when they're making noise, things are fine.
Even when they're fighting.
If it sounds like breaking shit, fine. But when they're quiet, coup.
It means they're plotting.
Oddly knowledgeable for a man who has an only child. But
he has older siblings.
Quite true.
So anyhow, as I mentioned, Khomeini was really opposed to the power shift that was happening. But as a student, he was stuck following the leaders and kind of keeping quiet. Even were he able to start a movement at this point in time or to establish one, he definitely did not have enough pull to get anyone anywhere. So he realized, hold back, get more power. This went on for a number of years, during which Khomeini worked to grow his followers. His main source of new followers was his students, as he was able to influence their thoughts more than those of the higher scholars. Classic. Like, inundate the youth because they have impressionable minds. In 1955, a movement against the Baha'i faith, which I can't understand because I've been on the Baha'i commune, and they are some of the most fucking peaceful and accepting people on the planet. But anyhow... A movement against the Baha'i faith was sparked, and Khomeini was all for it. as he was pretty locked into his religion, being the only one of value. Here's where Zealot comes in. He and his followers were still incapable of getting the support of the upper leaders, and the movement kind of fell a little flat, but he got a, like, he started rolling the wheel down the hill.
Okay, well, here's one of your problems with the Beehive thing. It's when you have a sect that says, hey, you know what? We believe what we believe. You do you, we'll do us, and we'll go along. Flies, and it's a direct contradiction to mine is the only way. And they don't like that whole, hey, let's just go ahead and get along and communicate and work things out, as opposed to, no, we need to crush our enemy under our foot, and this is the only thing that needs to happen.
And that's the Zealot part of it, is that we are the only ones that are right. There is no right in anything else, and it is, in my opinion, one of the most problematic parts of religion. But and most of them can be blamed for it.
They all have it. Every organized religion has a zealot.
Has some idiot saying why everybody else is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's actually quite logical. Is if you are trying to convince people that you're right, you try to convince the people that are closest to you first, rather than those that are wildly divergent.
Yeah. Yeah. You need help to be able to attack the others.
Right. So, you know.
QAnon. Go ahead.
Fuck off. Shut up.
Go ahead.
Jesus Christ.
You know, it's like if you're trying to sell snowboarding, you convince people it's kind of like skateboarding, even though it isn't. Instead of going to the people that are on skis or the mm-hmm. people on four-wheel roller skates. You know, you approach the people buying the, what do they call those, the inline skates. You approach the inline skaters first.
As opposed to
the skateboarders.
Schools.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
It's like if somebody listens.
Hey, you want to try something new?
If somebody listens.
First time's on me.
If somebody listens to Yes, you're like, you might like Love
every
Supreme.
Every good cocaine habit starts. So all of this. All of this horse shit kind of shifted a little bit when Ayatollah, again, honorific, Borujerdi, B-O-R-O-U-J-E-R-D-I, Borujerdi, died in 1961. He was one of the last of the old guard, and his death left an opening for Khomeini. His writings started getting published, Khomeini's writings, and it was not long before he was the new face of the Iranian religious leadership. In the fall of 1962, the Iranian government changed the law stating that all elected officials were to be sworn in on the Quran, because it was a religiously based constitution at that point in time.
Yeah.
This weakened the presence of the Islamic faith in Iran's government and strengthened the position of the Baha'i and the Jews, but we'll get to
how
them.
Is it if you're being sworn in on the Quran, that's lessening the faithful?
It's kind of like the argument right now in the States of let's not get sworn in court on the Bible.
Yeah, there's
if you're Baha'i or you're Jewish, you don't want to swear in on the Quran. That's not your religious text.
Oh, okay, so it's trying to bring in the other sects.
They swear in the president on the Bible.
Yeah, it's a very progressive. It's a progressive, open religious outlook as opposed to very closed. Only,
yeah, but to us, it's a little bit different. To them, because of, you know, centuries of political and religious, the way that they've been intertwined, it means it's a much larger slap in the face to them when you say, we can't use the Quran when we're swearing somebody in politically.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent to shooting or raping somebody's daughter in
That's
front of them.
That's quite literally part of their culture.
Yeah.
And
it is fundamental.
It was kind
culture.
Of a political affront to people at Khomeini.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it was directly to Khomeini because he sent telegrams to the prime minister and a few religious leaders telling him to stop the challenge and challenge them if they did not, he would arrange a giant ass protest. In January of 1963, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran, who was a Facebook hint in a great fucking I'm the leader costume, announced his reform epaulets, the whole bit, announced his reform program, the White Revolution, which minimized religion in Iran's government. So this is exactly what Khomeini was against.
Yeah,
the plan. Yeah,
this marked the end of times for him.
Yeah, yeah. The plan was inspired by the U.S. And moved Iran into a period of more progressive leadership. Khomeini and his followers were appalled and sent someone to judge how serious the Shah was. This, in turn, inspired the group to declare a boycott of the Shah and the plan. So, the Shah is essentially equivalent to king. I mean, it's not...
King president.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like elected king.
It would be like if the emperor of Japan and the prime minister were wrapped up into one nice little tidy package.
That, yeah, it. But that, I mean, again, it's an honorific. It's not necessarily who you are.
You're kind of glossing over a bunch of stuff here.
There's British. The British influence wasn't just American. Mm-hmm. There was a colonization effect. There was the the oil, the everything
So like, essentially, we're kind of coming out of World War I and World War II, and the Middle East, pretty much as a whole, is a feudal system. Based governments,
because it was broken up by the Western civilizations.
Yeah. No. They were feudal long before.
Oh, they were
existed under monarchies in whatever territories they had prior to the World War I, World War II boundaries being drawn. They were feudal states, and so they had kings and all this kind of whatnot. And so then we get to the end of World War II, and it's like we got this Iran place with all this goddamn oil. And
that we've now used so much during the war, and we now are very reliant upon.
World War II makes access to oil readily apparent.
Yeah. See, just a handful of episodes ago, exactly.
The need.
And you got to have the oil flowing. And so what are we going to do about all these feudal states? The Middle East states are also seeing they've had contact with the outside world a little bit because of this oil thing. They have to engage in trade, and then we have Iran, which remarkably elects in a pretty fully democratic election the best you're going to do in this region.
It is. To this day, one of the most democratic elections that has happened.
But they elect
and at that time of year, or that time.
They elect a guy named Mossadegh, who was the first democratically elected leader of a Middle Eastern state in our time. But the problem with Mossadegh was like, hey man, we just got done with World War II, and these schmucks over here up in Europe want all this oil. They're taking advantage of us, and why do we...
And I need to afford epaulets.
Yeah, and why... No, Mossadegh was actually like a... He was like a... he was full-on democratic leader.
Yeah.
You know, he was not a ten-pot dictator. He was just... He was elected by the people, and he starts stirring up shit. Like, why do we cede control of this region of our country to British Petroleum to pump out our oil?
He was majorly in the, like, we now know what our worth is. Why are we letting them try to dictate to us what we need to be doing?
Exactly.
We need to stand up and we need to start dominating because we have the supply.
Right. So
they have the demand.
So the U.S. and the European powers do not like this because, like,
not even a little bit. You could call it the UN. It's fine.
So
it's not the UN.
So the CIA goes in and stages the CIA goes in and stages essentially a coup. That they've acknowledged that they've done it. It's not secret anymore.
Yeah. Nope.
Where they depose Mossadegh and install the Shah.
Yep.
And they do this because the Shah is like a big political figure, but he's not in charge of the country. The Shah comes in and he's a monarch.
Yeah.
We put in a monarch there because he's like, look, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And the Shah, when he is...
Well, that's how monarchy works, yeah.
Right, but he's installed... And the Shah at this time, like shortly after his installation into the 60s and stuff like that, now becomes the most, he was the richest man in the world.
Yes, he was.
There was nobody richer than him.
Yep.
He was on the Sunday.
It's funny. I was thinking about that today, or not today, the other day while I was writing this. And it was like the Shah of Iran was always the richest guy on the planet. He had all the Bentleys.
Well, not always.
All the everything, right? Well, in my head. In my head, because I grew up in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
And I just stopped for a second because I got to take breaks while writing this. And I was like, so is Jeff Bezos the Shah of the world right now? And it was just the weirdest fucking thought. I didn't rest on it for very long, but it was the weirdest thought because the amount of money kind of denotes that place in society of I can just do anything and make deals with whomever I'd like. And it was a weird little thought. And you're looking at me like I'm totally off track. Which I kind of am.
I think it's a little bit different because, like, the Shah of Iran then was, like, then there was a different level of wealth where, you know, if Jeff Bezos decided, like, fuck you guys, we couldn't shop on Amazon, and that's really about it.
Yeah.
Whereas the Shah of Iran could shut down the world.
Yes. Yeah.
Rockefeller was the American...
Bezos will lose his, some of the events did.
Rockefeller
will lose his wealth if stock markets stop happening.
Rockefeller was a man who could shut down the world. He was, yeah. Rockefeller yeah. was like the no American Shah.
Yep.
Yeah, here's you where know. You stop the engine of the world.
Yeah. Whereas, I'm not sure
the
Bezos...
The Shah could do it.
I'm not really sure okay. that...
That may be our oldest joke.
Like Bezos couldn't really do that.
Yeah. Bezos would just put a really big...
He would just open up the flowering for everybody else.
If Bezos said, fuck this shit...
I'm going home.
The big difference is now you have to pay shipping.
Yes.
So, pretty much right? it.
Yeah, if he took away Prime, people mm-hmm. would scream.
So,
and he'd lose a lot of money.
Again, so, you know, essentially this plan was inspired by the Western cultures and moved the Iran into a much more progressive period of leadership. Khomeini and his followers were
appalled. Secular. It wasn't progressive.
I mean, he was at least accepting of other religious people of other religions. He wasn't just...
It was a practical aspect. It was practical. It wasn't... He moved,
he
believed
he moved Iran into the yeah. first modern One Middle paragraph. Eastern state.
Yeah.
They became the first modern Middle Eastern state where they had women's rights. They yes. had yes. Driving. Yes. You could yes. drive,
and you could have multiple religious facilities yeah. in one city. And
oh,
right.
that
most,
yes, rule.
Most,
that was
most,
a big deal.
Most
yeah.
importantly, yeah, that's actually true. Is like you could have conflicting religious facilities there, and they were equally tolerated.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The downside was. You can't say shit about the Shah.
You could have a Baha'i temple
yeah.
just down the street.
You say anything about the Shah, and you're going to get 86th in the middle of the night. But other than that, it's pretty good.
Yeah, the only time that any of the old school Quran punishments came into being is if you did any of the offenses against the Shah.
Yeah, that
and
was it.
And then you're stoned.
Yeah.
So that's leading a little bit. But anyhow, Khomeini and his followers were appalled and sent someone to judge how serious the Shah was. This, in turn, inspired a group to declare a boycott of the Shah and the plan. Khomeini gave a well-noted speech about the dangerous effects of the plan on his religious culture and publicly denounced the effort. 2 days later, the Shah gave an opposing speech denouncing Khomeini and his group. So now we've got a pretty
yep,
hefty opposition.
So is Khomeini still in Iran at this point? Or
yes,
has he
he's
abandoned
still in Iran.
It?
He's still in
or
Iran.
Has he
we
left?
Have not. We have. We're getting there. I promise. I didn't leave it out.
We're almost there.
I will punch you very hard if
I
you left it out.
I promise. I didn't leave it out.
Okay.
The place where all good dictators go.
I will punch
I
you so hard if you left it out.
God,
okay.
I want to see you punch him. I do. I want to see you punch
cause,
him.
Because that
well,
was my Christmas present. Is an imagining Tyler's
that would be
glee.
That would be my Christmas
imagining
present.
Imagining Tyler's glee, where it's like, and there you
watching
go.
Watching you punch him would be my Christmas present. So do it anyway.
Well, no, he came over on Christmas Eve. While I was writing this, I was like, oh shit! And I'm closing windows. He's like, what? Porn? I was like, no research!
Oh, you were three quarters erect at that point. Please, it's bigboots.com.
So, this,
big boots and corsets.
All of this sparked the beginning of what was to be a long bit of battling between the two classes. Khomeini issued a manifesto signed, yep,
There you go, bub.
Signed by
there
eight,
you go.
Eight other religious
first problem
leaders.
With anything. Yep. Manifestos.
When you got a manifesto, you're a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Signed by eight other religious leaders, making you a bigger problem. So listing the ways.
You've written a manifesto, haven't you, Tyler?
Yes, I have. Listing the ways in which the new plan, and hence the Shaw, violated the Constitution and spread moral corruption throughout the country, as well as claiming that the plan was just the leaders of Iran submitting to the U.S. and Israel. So now he's chosen his enemies, too.
The Israelis?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Folks. Great. Those Jesus folks. Christ. They're just a whipping boy.
Yeah, they are. It's just not cool. Continuing to blame the U.S. and Israel for the continuing disaster in Iran, or that Iran was becoming, Khomeini continued to speak out against the change to a more modern governmental style or system. In June of 1963, he gave another speech calling out the Shah for causing the collapse of the Iranian culture and society. 2 days later, Khomeini was arrested. Almost immediately, violent protests broke out in the major cities of Iran, with the common phrase being, death to the Shah, death to America, death to Israel.
Wow, the greatest hits of Islam.
Right. They're the most popular 45s you can get. The protests were met with even more violence when the Shah used tanks and paratroopers in a fucking city, which is impractical to say the least. But he used tanks and paratroopers to fucking stop him. It took 6 days and forever broke Iran in two. Iran, to this day, has not recovered from this. That's an opinion. Khomeini was moved to a higher security prison and was released in 1964 to return to Qom. Now, I don't understand how you get, 9 months for an actual insurgence.
Yeah,
nine months
seems a little bit lightweight.
Would you like to turn him into a martyr?
Especially there.
Yeah.
Would you like to turn him into a martyr?
Fair argument.
Well, actually, it would be a martyr.
just get the fuck out of here and go back home, I think is what happened. The Shah kept his movement up, and Khomeini kept fighting against it. He started claiming that the Jews were going to take over Iran. And
Khomeini did.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
The Jews were going to take over Iran, and that would only increase the Western belief that Iran was essentially a country enslaved to American ideals. He was fucking out for blood at this point in time.
You know, I don't know how you sell this. The Jews are going to take over.
And that's America's fault.
Could somebody please...
The Jews have never taken anything over other than a desert. That's questionable.
When did the Jews take over?
Nothing.
Where did the Jews take over?
When they beat down Jesus? And this isn't your book.
It's just asinine to me that
now it's a podcast.
Everybody's got this thing that the Jews are going to take over, where the Jews never take over anything. The Jews are
nobody
usually
5'2" with a nose you can hit from 8 foot away is
the Jews are usually
you can take your whole woke thing
and
put it back in the garage.
Yeah. Yeah, stuff it in a knish there over, Eichmann.
Jesus fucking Christ.
I know, that was
take your woke vehicle, put it back in the garage, and leave your keys at the table.
I was watching some older TV.
Really? Even on a smaller scale, when was the last time some guy was walking down a dark street and was like, I hope we don't find any Jews? The Jews don't take over shit. They're mostly can we please be left alone? We're doing our little thing over here. You guys think it's weird. We think it's okay, And it's just
only reason they're afraid of the Jews here, and let's be realistic, is they're afraid of Israel, is because the United States has figured out that the only way to keep any kind of control over there is Israel. So we fund the fuck out of them so that we have a little place that we can put things like armament, and we have a little tiny sphere of influence. And we make sure that we are really good friends with Israel all the way through. So, and that's why they don't,
the Jews also, the whole political thing where this is our land, this is your land, we fight to the death over it. That's happened on the religious front.
A little. I mean, it's like the Jews basically are sitting around on Masada, and it's like, look, we got this little plateau over here. Why don't you Romans get the fuck out? And it's like they
yeah, that didn't really work for him, though.
No, it didn't really work. But, you know, I mean, it's just like basically they're, you know, great Jewish conquests in world history is a pretty short book. You know, it just doesn't
Killing Jesus, though, that was a pretty...
Well, another problem.
That was a good page in that
book. Situation
it may only have 5 pages, but that one was an entire page.
Like, it's really the Jewish occupied part of the Middle East is one of the two smallest countries down there.
But it
happens to be the two that the Western culture makes the best friends with, like Israel and Kuwait, the two smallest fucking countries down there. That's who we want to work with all the time. I don't fucking get it.
Why don't you get it? It's pretty fucking simple.
They're the smallest countries.
Yeah, it doesn't matter the it
ain't the size. It's the motion of the ocean and the amount of money behind it.
All of a sudden, John's slapping ass on a podcast. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know where that's going. But
the size of the country isn't important. It's the amount of money that country has and who that country's friends are. That's where it becomes important.
So in the autumn of 1964, Khomeini gave another speech against the Shah because he was already arrested and out again.
You get out after 9 months, you start talking back.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, this motherfucker. Lenny Bruce eventually learned, quit fucking talking, they quit arresting you. But whatever. Maybe he learned through death, but that's an arguable thing. Anyhow, he gave another speech against the Shah, and this time they arrested him again. He was deported to Turkey this time, however. This effectively isolated him not only from his followers, but his religion, as even the religious garments that he wore were illegal in Turkey. So he split from Turkey and went to Iraq in 1965. So, like, less than a year and just, like, elected to go to a different prison in a totally different country.
I think it's important to keep in mind that when a government decides to send somebody to exile... they have to find another government where it's like, yeah, we'll take him.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like that. So
Turkey's... Well, there was a bunch of that went on. Like, yeah. He was like, no, ship me to this place. There, and that country was like, nope. He was like, well, then ship me to this place. That country's like, nope.
Yeah, and what
year... And Turkey was finally like, eh, sure.
What year are we in?
We got things called Turkish prisons.
What year are we in?
They're world-renowned.
But what year are we in now?
We're 1965-ish.
Okay, so to put this into perspective, you know, everybody in the Middle East has, like, their pain-in-the-ass population or person that they want to exile. And it's like, look, you call somebody up on the phone, and it's like, will you take this pain-in-the-ass? It's kind of like when you want to dump a girlfriend.
Yeah, because you can't just dump them in the desert. That gave us Gaddafi.
Even though they had a lot of desert... Yeah. They can't do that. It's
because they'll just build a fucking stronghold right there in the middle of the desert, these industrious
fuckers.
Because
what you want is to deport this person or this populace to a place where it's like, look, if you can take them and give them a nice life, you know, we'll pay you some stuff and keep them on the hamster wheel. Don't ever let them come back.
Yeah.
Don't let them come back. Keep them happy.
We're now using their tactics against them.
Yeah, give them full cable and stuff. So in terms of perspective here, you know, it's just like, you know, you got the Palestinians and they're just like... you know, what are we going to do with these? So they deport the Palestinians to Jordan, and Jordan's, like, not really into them. Jordan takes them, and that's how we get Black September, because you get this bunch of unruly's who are all cranky, and the King of Jordan had to, like, you know, do Black September and have a massacre of the Palestinians.
Again, spoiler alert, we're going to come up on some of that kind of shit, too. It's not quite the same, but similar.
I don't believe it, because I don't believe you've done this much research, but if you have, props to you.
So while in exile, Khomeini developed his theories and eventually started teaching Velayat-e, however that said, Faqih, I think I can say.
Velayat Faqih,
okay. What's with the hyphen E thing? I don't get that.
I don't know. Velayat is some sort of word in...
Are you talking about what is translated as Discovery of Secrets?
Yeah, it's that kind of thing.
Keshefi Asar.
No, this is Velayat Faqih.
Keshef Ye Asar.
Velayat is a word that comes up in Arabic.
It's another one of those
things.
It's
a very meaningful word. I don't entirely know what it means.
Yeah. Anyhow, it is essentially a faith-based theory for a clergy-led government. That much I was able to get. His followers flocked
to... Fun time.
I know. His followers flocked to study with him, and he started videotaping his sermons. So it's like the late 60s, early 70s, he's got technology in the middle of the fucking Middle East.
So he's like Bob Crane with the porn cam?
Yeah.
Just for shits and giggles, let's go ahead and let's... Now that he has technology, let's go ahead and let's read back to one of the quotes you said where... There can be no fun and no joy in whatever is serious. This dog does not allow swimming in the sea, and it is opposed to radio and television serials.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so radio, things like that, things that obviously, well, I mean, at this point in time, were methods of communication and indoctrination.
It was indoctrination. It was a further, another aspect of the Western culture coming into his that he was trying to fight against. And so it made him kind of a troglodyte to some extent for quite a while. But now he is like, well, I don't know. I'm in Turkey. No, he's not in Turkey. He's in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And it's technically imprisoned. It's kind of a pretty fucking cush,
there is
Escobar-like prisonish with situation. But, and he's like, so let's make some videotapes in the late 60s, early 70s. Well, videotape was not real common then.
The videotapes, however, because they're not serials.
What do you mean?
Television shows.
No, these are straight up,
exactly. Documentaries, fucking... things like that. Educational would be okay. However, there's the whole radio and propaganda bullshit that's going on here.
Oh, no, he's straight the propaganda side. He's just delivering speeches that are anti-Shah, and that's what he's doing so that he can communicate with his followers back home because they literally started taking the videotapes and smuggling them back into Iran and selling them on the streets so that his followers could still listen to them and be moved by his speaking. Hence, increasing his popularity, because now he's kind of like a cultish black cinema figure or something. Like he's black outside the norm
figure.
Yeah, black cinema, just like black comedy, outside the norm.
Oh, you mean dark?
Okay, dark. Fine, whatever. Okay. Now, either way, it gave him actually a better grasp on his leadership and helped grow his movement a ton because he was growing it in Iraq, and by having these videotapes shipped into Iran and sold on the black market, he is becoming kind of this cultish, that's a better word, cultish figure.
This is also where we need to touch on the concept of jihad.
Not quite yet.
Not yet.
Well,
not quite yet. He is that's jihad, close to the end.
I'm just going to, no, I'm going to say this. There are two different definitions of jihad. Depending
also
on when you're
notoriously never declares jihad.
Holy
but
fuck.
Go ahead. Holy fuck, whatever. Go ahead. He didn't declare it.
Jihad is whether you're a fundamentalist or you're a progressive member of the Islamic faith, jihad can be a very personal struggle within yourself, or it can be a very personal struggle with opposing forces outside of you. And
the internal tends to be more the religious path, and the external tends to be more zealotrous path.
As with most religions, Buddhism, Taoism, they have the same basic concepts behind them. Loosely given there, okay?
Technically, so do the Mormons, but anyway.
Within jihad, though, the fundamentalists allow you to adopt Western concepts. They allow you to be a spy and use and manipulate things like media and do things like that. So that's a little hit and a half as to what might be going on here and the frame of reference that they're coming up with.
Well, I think that we have a mistranslation, which I think is a little bit what you're getting at, John, of jihad. Where we don't really...
We've done this before.
We look at it as this, like, exclusively Islamic thing, whereas...
It's because it's an Islamic term, and so we naturally apply it to that,
right.
Which isn't fair.
The fact that you don't talk about it now?
Because it's a common theme in a lot of religions. There just is a different word for it.
Okay, so, but, like, the concept of jihad is struggle.
Yes.
And this recurs in any philosophy or religious life, is internal struggle. That's what religion is based upon, is internal struggle.
That's why the word faith exists.
Right. And so when we regard it as like this alien term that like, why are these people constantly fighting? It's like most of our philosophies are struggling against the real world, or the physical world versus our own internal moral world. And all religions focus upon this. And then in popular culture, if you think that this is an alien term, I would invite you to remind that the entire Dune series is based upon this concept of bringing really pretty much all of Muslim philosophy and stuff. It's used explicitly in Dune, the term jihad, as to why these people are fighting on Arrakis and all this kind of thing. And so really, I don't regard it as this crazy-ass alien philosophy, because it's actually quite close to home.
So, not that I have any disagreement at all. We've had this conversation a lot.
We have.
I'm just going to move on. Mm-hmm. I hope that's not insulting.
Please do with okay. most expediency.
By 1977 through 78, Khomeini's followers had started an effective push against the Shah's continued westernization of Iran. The Shah's response was to ask the Iraqi government to toss Khomeini out of their country. Before they did, Khomeini went where all dictators seem to end up. Where did he end up, Rupert?
I'm thinking...
Kale Supreme.
I'm thinking Eclairs. If one could be exiled...
Why does France take all the fucking dictators?
Rue the dictator.
I think because it's easy. You just say to this schmuck...
You buy a beret at the corner shop and they let you the fuck in. I don't know what's going on.
I think what it is you send... You're in this like...
You wave the France flag, it means you surrender.
This has become such a common historical theme that I don't get it.
Because if you're in one of
these... And then followed by jazz musicians.
It keeps them relevant.
If you're in one of these countries, you send the secret police... You send the secret police and you're like, hey, bub, you can go to our dark hole prison, or you can go to this place where they have a lot of patisserie.
And they hate everybody here.
Would you like croissants?
Would you like croissants or the, you know...
Would you like being whipped?
It's croissants or crucifixion. Because we do crucifixion here. We still do it.
We put heads on pikes still.
Yeah, we'll still do it.
We'll make you into cheese, you motherfucker. These guys, I don't know why, France.
So they pick the patisserie.
Yeah,
and the next thing you know, you got a guy in a fucking black robe eating an eclair and a Napoleon saying...
And what's more is this is another occasion...
How much weight did he gain when he was there?
This is another occasion... well, okay. This is another occasion where he's the Khomeini...
I bet he could make an omelet now. Well, he could.
This is another occasion.
After he left, I bet he can make an omelet.
That's a great YouTube video. The Ayatollah Khomeini makes an omelet. That's
Martha
a good
Stewart
one.
Martha Stewart be in it?
Oh. That would be a good thing.
Fucking internet gold.
That would be a good thing.
This is another occasion where he's literally shopping around for a country to go to.
Will you take this asshole, please?
I don't know why he wasn't the
and
first
he's,
step.
He's shopping around. It's not the government going, where's the shittiest place we can stand? Like, it's not America going, fucking Gitmo. It's fucking, just, I don't know, France. I like baguette.
Well, honestly, anymore, we say Gitmo, France, or Russia. Which one do you want?
So, I end all be all, yet another motherfucking dictator ends up in France.
Yeah.
And
to be fair, he's in good company.
And it's late 60s, so like the jazz scene is heavy. So the and acid rock is starting to happen in Europe, and who knows what happened to him then.
So there's where we come back to Rock the Casbah.
My fondest fantasy is
Sharif don't like it.
I a little bit.
I just love this picture of, like, the Ayatollah walking down the Champs-Élysées, stopping by a cafe, and seeing Jim Morrison, Baby Doc,
Right.
And Pol Pot sitting there having an, you know, they're sharing an omelet or something.
They're sharing lemon writings.
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, because he's sitting there in France at the same time as Pol Pot or, well, I don't know. But like, you know, it's just.
I've not been, but I really don't get this part of France. Anyway, for some reason, he was able to grow followers even from France.
Can you imagine how much work MI6 had to put into keeping track of them?
Merry Christmas. Here's your bow.
Thank you for that. I love that you could drive this towards France. I love that.
The growing Islamic regime headed by Khomeini continually butts heads with the more progressive Shah regime. And on September 8th, 1978, the Shah declares martial law in an effort to stop the rebellion. His military fires on protesters in Tehran, killing at least 100 people. This becomes known as Black Friday.
Dun, dun, dun.
Boom.
Khomeini's
reach. Bloody
Sunday.
Yeah, it is. Horrible. It is one of those. It is straight up right next to Bloody Sunday.
Try and like think about what these people were protesting, because the Shah is moving Iran into a more modernistic society where women can drive and own property
and show their face and all that stuff. Yeah, yeah.
And
I don't know that we got there yet, but at least they
did.
I don't
think we're there yet.
Yeah. But women can wear pants. Just chuck on a headscarf, call it good.
Mary Tyler Moore shows up.
At least they can have a fucking driver's license.
It's like,
I mean, shit.
Women in Iran at this point looked like your mom when she had curlers on. Tie a scarf around it, call it good, but drive and go to the butcher and get some bacon. You know,
I don't think bacon.
Well,
but anyhow.
The people protesting and saying, like, let's have something more repressive. Could we have something more repressive here? There's too much freedom going on. Too much people buying, like, records and the Beatles, and we don't like it, and we want some repression.
And they all stood in line and said, why should we do it this way?
Yeah. Well, all this led to some even more crazy shit. Because Khomeini,
I think these protests were led by a bunch of guys who couldn't get laid.
Well, we're getting into that.
Uh-huh. You think so?
Khomeini's reach was very effective. And in December of 1979, several thousand Jews protested the Shah.
Here you go, Bob.
Which was effectively protesting their own religious freedoms in Iran. They did not. They did this because they were, quote, advised, was the word I saw used most, to take part in the protests, not because they felt it was the right thing to do. This made the uprising too large for the Shah to fight against, and he left Iran in January 1979 of his own volition. He's like, fuck it, out.
Sort of.
So how long did he live after that?
This wasn't the story of the Shah.
I think it's just like this, you know, it's just this inherent, like, you know, bad trait about the Jews where like they constantly seem to be like picking a bad source, like how the Jews, you know, come upon like, hey guys, let's all move to Germany, this looks like a good idea, and then that turns
well, he finally died and
that turns on them.
Halabi died in Cairo.
That comes later. Yeah. But then, like, the Jews are sitting around like, hey, let's support this, like, Orthodox Muslim uprising against, like, you
against,
know.
Against, well, us and the Baha'is.
Yeah, like, what the fuck are you thinking?
Quote, advised. Like, it sounds like advised at the barrel of a gun. Kind of advised to me. That's the way I was able to read it.
I don't get it.
I don't get it either. And that's why I put that word in quotes. So this made the uprising too large and the Shah to fight against. He left in 1979. 2 weeks later, Khomeini returned to his home. 2 weeks later. Like, Khomeini, like, it's like fucking the widow. Like, the husband's not even dead yet. But two weeks later, Khomeini returned to his home country and was celebrated as a hero in the Islamic
community. Okay, so can I put some context into this?
Yeah, totally.
Some real-time context. So when this is going on, I was fully an adult and very aware of what was going on. And it was like crazy because you had this guy, the Shah, who was like a king. And we were, you know, in the U.S., we were just like, really? You're going to depose a king? How do you have a king? That's very strange.
That alone
still,
is weird, yeah.
You're still living under a monarchy. Okay. And so it's...
They were totally into Princess Di at the time. But
right.
Go ahead.
No, she hadn't been born yet,
oh,
I don't
right.
think.
Oh, no, she was born. But
well,
was
whatever. But
Elizabeth was still a thing.
It doesn't matter. So at any rate, like in the U.S., we're all sitting around like this king's got to get out of there because the people don't like the king anymore. And it became this thing where Jimmy Carter was sitting around like somehow it fell upon the U.S. to find a country that would take the Shah because nobody wanted to take him. Mm-hmm. Strangely, I don't really
it's
understand.
It's another one of those shopping around things.
Yeah, yeah. It was a shopping around thing where it was just like, what the hell are we going to do with this guy?
We do get to the U.S. part, but go ahead. Yeah.
And so the U.S. did not want to take this guy because it was quite clear. It was quite clear he was on the outs and he wasn't going to survive this. But if the U.S. takes him, that means... You know, we're inexorably in opposition to whoever
we're now
shows
fuck
up.
Fuck off with the Ayatollah, yeah.
Right.
So whatever now, Ayatollah.
It is now political hot potato.
Yeah. So it's hot potato. Exactly.
Good
That's
fucking
good,
way to say it, yeah.
Good way of saying it. So in that time, this was like really pretty much one of the hardest things Jimmy Carter faced was like, what the fuck are we going to do with it? Because we put this guy in.
Well, yeah, and Carter knows how to raise peanuts.
And so Jimmy Carter's like searching well. Around for what the hell really to well. Do with this guy. And he's like, well, you know, we could tell France to send the Ayatollah to Iran and then tell France to take the Shah of Iran.
Shah, exactly. It's a straight trade.
And he's thinking about that. You know, it's just like
my Boba Fett for your lightsaber Darth Vader. We could do this.
And
then he winds up with...
Then there's a lot of money involved.
Then he winds up with what I call the Nazi alternative of South America. South America.
Here we come, Ecuador.
Let's send him to what is known as the junk room in the house, where we just throw all the shit.
You just throw some fucking Hitler following Nazi in the jungle and leave him to die.
Yeah, like Werner von Braun, you know, all
exactly.
this stuff. And it's the juncture. And if you have a small house or an apartment.
Werner von Braun was taking
Small house or apartment, it's the juncture on
it's
your
where
kitchen.
All the screwdrivers
yeah.
and rubber bands are, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so Jimmy Carter figures out. Let's just say that the Shah has medical issues which can somehow only be treated in an obscure South American country not known for its medical facilities. So he doesn't go to Johns Hopkins.
No.
Oddly, the king of the world, the richest man in the world, winds up in South America, I think.
So, anyhow, Khomeini, thank you for the context. Khomeini immediately sets to constructing an entirely new constitution for Iran that left Jewish people as second class, literally defined them as second class citizens, with
also
fewer rights.
Also known as slavery.
Yes. I was, you know, trying to be kind. As well as turning the Baha'i into literal fucking criminals. Over 200 Baha'i were killed all over Iran with the government sanction.
200.
They were like in the Market Square beheadings. It wasn't just like military rushing in
statements.
And killing them blindly. It was like,
these
let's
weren't
string them up.
If you see 200, they're like cockroaches. If you see 200, there's 1,000 that
yeah.
you didn't see.
These
are the public things.
It was quite
not
messy.
Not the ones that happened in the middle of the night where
yeah,
they just
and,
disappeared.
And a lot of these numbers have been written by the victors, and so... There's that to take into consideration as well. It's still – they fucking just started killing anybody that was anywhere near Baha'i. It's an extinction movement. Jewish people started fleeing the country left and right. And the Khomeini-
late in the game.
Why
late
don't you
in the
just
game.
Go ahead and restate what? That in a different way? They left like rats on a ship.
Fleeing the country left and right. And the Khomeini leadership was able to become more militant – eventually declaring that Israel and Zionism needed to be destroyed. Within 3 years, over 80,000 Jews documented left the country.
Yeah.
Within 3 years, 80,000 documented people left. Fuck it. Out.
Those are the people that wanted to keep their money.
Their lives. Fuck the money.
Well,
they documented it so that they could actually hold bank accounts in foreign countries
when they moved
like
into
that,
Israel,
and then move themselves and their families and do things in
a way that
was recognized by other countries. But then you had those who were so fucking poor that
the Jews left Iran for the same reason the Jews left Nazi Germany.
Yes.
They just wanted to stay alive.
For some reason, they realized they were subject to an extermination movement 40 years later, it's like watching The Honeymooners on TV. It's like, really, again? Jesus, okay.
I really feel it for Jewish culture because fucking continually the butt of the joke. This essentially ended a long-standing relationship between Iran and the Western world, most specifically the U.S. The earlier breakup of the Middle East had long been disliked by those living there, and the recent decrease in the price of oil had left much of the area in economic disarray. This made it easy for Khomeini to take reins, since anyone other than his extremist Islamic followers was now considered an enemy of their own way of life. So he's taken his zealot. He's so fucking dedicated to some weird primal shit in his fucking religion that he is now against everybody, and he's found a way to put it in place and use it as a ruling way of life.
This has been brewing for
decades. He jumped on the back of a donkey that was already running.
Yeah, but this is something in him that's been brewing for decades. He's had this thing in his head.
Well, he's got that anger from his younger years when he wasn't allowed to speak up or anything.
This is what he's been doing. He's cultivated this anger and this hatred and this, this drive to institute.
I think it's actually more complex than that. But
it is definitely more complex than that. But it's... he's found a way in. Establishing the new government also made Khomeini the supreme leader. Vale-e-Faqih is what the term, I think, is.
I'm not worried about it.
He becomes a king.
He was a supreme.
Descended from God.
He becomes even, supreme leader.
Yeah.
Of Iran. And he intended to use that position. So, when the U.S. allowed the former Shah to come to the U.S., which Rupert discussed earlier, a group of Khomeini's followers took over the U.S. Embassy, which is a Facebook hint, and held over 60 people hostage.
The U.S. Embassy in Iran.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is now recounted, as the U.S. Iranian hostage crisis. To this day, the U.S. no longer holds an embassy in that country. There is no longer a U.S. embassy.
Damn right.
And has not been since this day. For good reason, because go there, they'll kill you.
It's a little bit singular because the U.S. has had embassies taken over before and after. I mean, that's what happens.
But they've also been able to reoccupy many of them.
Or, reestablish relations or something. But there was something very singular about the Iranian hostage crisis. And, it changed the Middle Eastern world. And it also changed our news.
Sensationalism became a thing.
From the Iranian hostage, crisis with the U.S. embassy begot a singular news program known as Ted Koppel's Nightline, where every single day of that hostage crisis, the news documented that our hostages were still there, being held in this embassy, and it brought down a presidency of Jimmy Carter and inaugurated Ronald Reagan, which the news could never tolerate.
It was so much for media to take.
Yeah.
It was super overwhelming. Not unlike this year, oddly, but it was so overwhelming. The media couldn't take it. This was all happening, as Rupert mentioned, to Carter as he was leaving office and Reagan was coming into the presidency. So America has so much to pay attention to. It's difficult for them to give any level-headed assessment of what's going on. Iran leveled sanctions on exports, as well as an embargo on oil shipments as the standoff continued. Khamenei was not fucking giving in. He's still out for blood. He's not giving up. Khamenei was aging, however, and in January of 1980, he underwent heart surgery. He spent 39 days in the hospital, and upon his release, he moved into a small home that would soon become a guarded compound from which he would finish his days as the supreme ruler of Iran. After a few months later, Iran was still unstable and in recovery when Saddam Hussein saw an opportunity, see that episode, to secure more of the Middle East for Iraq and launch an attack on Iran. This battle lasted about 6 years, and the countries are still at odds with one another. Again, due to Western dibbling, if you will. After hundreds of thousands had died because of the ongoing skirmishes, the UN stopped it in 1988 and eventually was able to establish a quote-quote ceasefire. I will continue to leave ceasefire in quotes. Khamenei held his belief that this was BS and called the deal, quote, more deadly than taking poison. It is the death to his culture as he knows it and has tried to bring it. Early in 1989, Khamenei was still in control of Iran when Salman Rushdie released a now legendary book, The Satanic Verses, which calls out Islamic beliefs as false. This book, although fiction, was considered to be a direct attack on the Islamic people of Iran, and Khamenei issued a fatwa.
First time we'd ever really heard that word in the Western world.
Calling for the death of Rushdie.
Fatwa.
Yeah, fatwa, do you guys want to, either one of you want to describe it? I didn't write it down.
It means basically a cleric issues a death order on this person.
Yeah, our religion is out to kill you.
It's essentially a license
to kill.
It's the mafia issues a contract.
For a guy who wrote a fictitious book.
Did you guys read the book?
Unfortunately, I have to say no.
So, Salman Rushdie was a moderately established author when this book comes out.
Kind of a journalist, if I remember or understand correctly. Like, he did some kind of...
He was not a nobody. Kind of he was not yeah. a nobody. And Salman Rushdie puts out this book, The Satanic Verses, and Ayatollah Khomeini issues a fatwa. Rupert Hughes was in the bookstore within hours to buy this book. I have to have this
book.
That's
one of the reasons I ever read it, is when people flock to stuff, I tend to dodge.
I have to read it because, like, I was just like...
What's the uproar? Yeah.
What's this all about? A. B. That book's going to be worth some money. If you get that edition.
It's like
edition.
Buying the metal copy of Madonna's sex book, yeah.
If you buy that edition, you know, you got it. And so I ran out immediately, like within hours.
Which went down the stairs to the bookstore in New York, right?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And I got this book, and the first offense is, like, he starts, like, describing Muhammad in a... Well, it's really the only offense, is he starts describing Muhammad in a lighthearted manner.
A comedic
manner.
Way, yeah.
Yeah, a comedic manner. And
what was that thing that happened in France recently that killed Chuck or killed whomever it was, the guy that did this again recently?
Well,
very serious thing.
Charlie Hebdo.
Thank you, Kill Charlie.
Basically, the book starts out with Muhammad and Jesus falling out of a plane having a little discussion about how things are going to go. You know? And it's
I'm all of a sudden enticed.
It's quite entertaining. It is one of the rare exceptions to the world of hype stuff about notoriety. You know what I'm talking about, where somebody hypes something as like a ultimate offense, where you read it and you're like, oh, I get it. That's kind of but it's also a good work. It's well written. Salman Rushdie is clearly a gifted writer. It's quite an entertaining book for both its writing and its imagery.
This is the first time a book review of that book has made me want to read it. Your Swedish movie reviews have worked in reverse for a change.
No, I would advise anybody to...
I may have to read it.
I think it would actually be a boring book, lacking the historical context.
But I was alive then.
If you read it...
I've already got a bookmarked.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I'll
buy it.
Yeah, you can buy two for $4.38.
I don't know if you guys are going to get it, but if you had read it in the historical context of, like, you know, this cataclysm going on in Iran, it's quite an interesting book.
Well, Rushdie was in hiding for what, like a decade and a half or some shit?
Still.
Because the entire Islamic culture is out to get him.
It's really the only time where, because Rushdie's living in London when this comes down.
Right.
And you're like, what the fuck? This country can order a hit on somebody and like blah, blah, blah. And so I got to read this
thing.
Well,
okay. See the Mossad episode. Yes. Infiltrating.
It's not quite as public. The Mossad keeps it a little bit on the down low. This was public. But you read it, and if you read it and don't think about the historical context uppermost in your mind, it's just another stupid book. But if you read it in terms of the historical context, you're like, oh, wow, this is like kind of cool.
So read it as alternate history fiction.
Read it with presence of mind.
Okay. I'm curious. I may read it. So anyhow, shortly after the release of the death warrant, Khomeini fell ill and landed in the hospital again, this time for internal bleeding. I couldn't find why. Ulcers, maybe.
Ulcers because you're wearing a robe and not showering.
Whatever.
Oh, you know that guy. You know that guy had BO like there would still
Well, he was living in a small house that had become a compound.
Oh, God.
He's any other fucking leader, dictator, asshole at this point in time. I'm holed up with my folks.
I don't know. The fact that you've lived in poverty for a lot of your upbringing.
No, John, please. Poverty in France. Hold on.
Eclairs.
Stop your swan
song. You learned how to do that when you were in your 20s. But you might have... He'd already had heart surgery at this point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He isn't in the best of health.
Well, dude, he was born in 1902.
Exactly.
It's 1989.
So,
he's not young anymore. He's 87 years old.
You're going to have some problems.
Boo-hoo, I'm in poor health and I'm king of a country. Boo-hoo.
So, anyhow, the operation to repair the issue did not work. And after 11 days, on June 3rd, 1989, Khomeini died in the hospital. Unfortunately.
Good fucking riddance.
Yeah, kind of. Unfortunately, his tenure rule and his influence prior to that had fractured the country and created a religious war zone that has affected global relations ever since. It has also meant that Jewish people who have family ties in Iran have never been safe in the country and are barely safe in Israel. And are barely safe in Israel since the hatred for them and their culture has not died off. Like, it could be said that a significant part of the instability of the Middle East to this day is due to him perpetuating it. It's one of those.
If you want to start wrapping it up, that would be a really good argument that I have.
You notice clicked on. Like I said, the guy is kind of just like in my head as a bad guy because of my memory of history and my time relationship to it. But I didn't even write down like the millions of people that were killed because of wars and shit that he kept going for no particular reason. And in the end, what I came down to is I don't even give a shit because it's just another example of you being a fucking religious zealot and so dedicated to your religion that you spend all of your time finding reasons why everybody else should die. And that is the wrong way to view religion. When you view religion as a way to inspire you to be a better person. And that is also written in all of these religions. And if people would spend more time focusing on the how to be a better fucking person part of it, instead of let's kill everyone else, and this argument goes long beyond religion, if we could just find ways to find common ground and similarities and not use our entire life as a reason to exterminate somebody else, everything would be just kind of weird, but better. And this fucker is just another example. I do miss that he didn't have a very good dictator costume. Like, go ahead.
I think this is one of those instances where we have conviction. And that is where we are at. Conviction and force of being. We have a person here that believes so wholeheartedly in one way of life, and he will sacrifice everything he sees around him to a vision, which isn't... there are dictators that see that, but there are others that... If you look through, like, some of the way the Roman Empire went through and said, okay, you know, we're going to take you over. You can believe in our gods or not. As long as you just give us, you know, the token, you know, proselytize before us and, you know, give us our tribute, we're fine. You do what you do, and we'll just move on. However, you need to pay Caesar his due. This isn't paying Caesar his due. This is, you will bow before me and bow before my vision of what's going on. And that's where things become dangerous. That's where people are able to wage war upon each other in ways that it's biblical. I mean, it really is. It's vicious, it's violent, it's horrible, and it's all done in the name of God. Some God, one God, their God, this God. They don't communicate. They don't need to communicate because they don't feel that you're on the level of communication with them. You don't get it. Therefore, you don't exist. You are just some other thing. And that is the scary fucking thing that continues to propagate. And this isn't just over in the Middle East. It's here, too. We do it with Westboro Baptist. They do it. There's the fanaticism that people have for their belief in their deity, their way of life, supersedes yours. Don't ever, ever let somebody fucking tell you you can't do a thing.
Before Rupert starts to jam in the egg,
it's going to be bad.
Have we're a sense. Need it. Yeah. Holy shit, y'all.
Well, you started it out that way, dude.
I didn't take any of this yet.
I know. You started me out with that fucking shit that you did.
So is it my turn?
Yes. Sorry.
I'm sorry I'm saying that in an antagonistic manner.
Not on this podcast.
I think that I view the Ayatollah Khomeini in a wildly divergent realm from the popular opinion of the man. I look at the actions where Khomeini gets thrown out of the Shah's Iran, where he is trying to make it increasingly – the Shah is trying to make it increasingly secular. Khomeini has a difference of opinion on this. He gets thrown out to Paris. Something that was glossed over here was that when the populace of Iran, after deposing the Shah, demands the return of Khomeini, Khomeini comes back fairly impartial. He's like, I don't know. They called me back. They want some religion. And Khomeini comes back, and he's actually impartial towards the U.S. He does not involve – he does not regard them as the great Satan. In his conversations with then-President Jimmy Carter, he sees a chink in the armor, when Carter sends him the letter, one a man of God to the other. Which, if you don't know it...
Oh, my God.
And it was glossed over in this podcast...
It was totally left out.
Read it.
Read it. Because Khomeini comes back into this chaotic country, and he's just like, I don't know, I guess I'm in charge. And he's wondering which way to go. And he's looking at his populace, where the most militant among them are quite anti-U.S., quite anti-European. And he doesn't know what to do. And Jimmy Carter writes him the one man of God to another thing, and Khomeini comes up with what is now common parlance of the U.S. is a paper tiger. They can't do anything.
Is that possibly the most well-known thing Carter ever did?
No, because it's not really well-known. And it's not really even Jimmy Carter's fault. I can't really say that Jimmy Carter was weak or bad or wrong in what he did with that.
I took that as one guy reaching out to another.
I took it as that, too, even though I despise Jimmy Carter and consider him absolutely...
As a president, he wasn't great. As an ex-president, I kind of like him.
I think philosophically, I regard Jimmy Carter as something of an idiot. But I think he's an inherently good person. I just think he's kind of ridiculous. Jimmy Carter is a man who lapses into the obvious and makes it appear as if it's genius. That's his talent. I don't understand him, and I don't want to get off on Jimmy Carter. But Jimmy Carter writes him the one man of God to another letter. And I don't know that I would have done different under Jimmy Carter's circumstances. I think it was actually a good reach out.
Yes.
And for reasons that, you know, Jimmy Carter's not down, he's not there on the ground. The Ayatollah Khomeini takes it as a sign of weakness and is like, I can unite my people in opposition to the U.S. And that was horrible for our country, but, you know, I think Jimmy Carter gave it his best shot. He gave it his best shot. And I thought it was considered. I don't think that Jimmy Carter wrote that letter in a hothead moment. I think he thought about it, and I think he was doing the best he could, and it just didn't work. Okay? And I've been thinking about this a lot in my own life recently, and there is nothing quite like the scorn which I have for the godless. I cannot. I have a hard time accepting the godless, the heretic. I can't do it.
Is it the godless or the faithless?
The godless. If you're a godless person, I will always have disagreement to you. However, your purpose in being a person of God, a man of God, is not to heap scorn upon those who are not. It is to help them.
Find God.
And you will never find joy in scorning the godless, even though this is the easy path.
It is, and the more common.
It is very, because it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can understand the godless and realize any straying from that path by virtue of their friend being their friend, if they remain on that path and they are your friend and you cannot convince them, dude, try this ice cream. Maybe you've failed.
This sounds like something your friends do.
I thought we were friends.
I'm extremely uncomfortable with that.
I know. Do you need help?